Hi everybody, today is Friday, August 29th, 2025, and our friend Dmitry Orlov is back with us. Welcome back, Dmitry.
Good to be with you once again.
Let's start with your weblog. How can we learn about it? You mentioned that you're working on a piece that is so much comprehensive. What is that about and when you're going to publish that?
I'm not sure when it's going to come out. I've been working on it, thinking it through for a while. It's about the end of Pax Americana and the beginning, positive, possible beginning of Pax Russica that was signaled by the meeting in Alaska, a passing of the baton, if you will. And I hope to have it wrapped up this coming week.
Yeah. And how can people read it then? Read your piece.
Go to the URL on your screen and join at whatever support level. There's an inexpensive one called Spare Change if you don't have much money. Join the club and then you'll have access to everything that I write, which is quite a lot.
Yeah. Let's start, Dmitry, with what has happened, the latest Russian attack on Kiev. And you know, it came after the attack, Ukrainian attack on one of the most important oil refineries in the south of Russia. What was the reason of this attack on Kiev? It was some sort of response to Kiev, or it was a sign to those people in Europe who are talking about building a factory, a drone factory, or somehow they want to produce weapons in Ukraine. What was that all about?
Okay, well, first of all, the attacks on oil refineries in Russia by the Kiev regime haven't really added up to much. I drove something like 10,000 kilometers all over Russia this summer. Never did I find a gas station that was out of fuel. And over the past week, the prices actually went down. So there isn't really a problem with refining in Russia. The Kiev regime has not succeeded in causing any major disruption. It's just an annoyance. Now, these drones that the Ukrainians have been able to put together are on the level of World War I aircraft. These are the sorts of craft that Baron von Richthofen would have flown in World War I. Not much better. Easy to shoot down, and there are somewhere between 50 and 100 of them that get shot down every night. There are some issues with shooting them down over population areas, so they do tend to crash in the industrial districts where they tend to hit something that then catches on fire. There's a lot of flammable junk in those areas. So the fire crews have to rush in and put them out, but it's just an annoyance, okay? So that's one thing to keep in mind, that the Ukrainians, the best they can do is be annoying, and the Russians are somewhat annoyed. Now, what some people might think is the Russian response, it's not a response. Russia doesn't really bother to impress either anyone in the West or the Ukrainians themselves. It just doesn't matter to them at all. It just doesn't enter into the calculus. And the calculus is they have good intelligence on where the drone aircraft are being put together. And once they have that intelligence, they act on it. So they destroyed a lot of the factories, a lot of the spaces where these drone aircraft are being put together or launched from or stored, or where the components are being warehoused. And all of that went up in flames. And the Ukrainians tried to shoot down some of the stuff that the Russians were throwing at them unsuccessfully. And some of the air defense rockets hit some apartment buildings. And that, of course, got blamed on the Russians. But this is the Kiev regime destroying its own apartment buildings as usual. Nothing new at all. They keep doing it every time. they have these air defense teams that are just not very good, and they use equipment that's not very good. A lot of it gets destroyed in the process. But what they cause is friendly fire, collateral damage to their own side, and this is what actually happened.
One of the targets was a Turkish Bayraktar plant, is a drone plant, which was under construction in Ukraine. Dmitry, when we talk about Turkey, somehow we think of Erdogan as somebody who wants to play both sides. But how do you find the role of Turkey in, together with Azerbaijan?
The role in what?
In the way that they're trying to somehow, why do they need to be there to be in Ukraine? What does it make sense to you?
Well, Turkey was sort of playing both sides in terms of getting some money from selling weapons to the Ukrainians, and those weapons were ineffectual. The Bayraktar drones played a limited role in the beginning of the conflict in 2022. They were, for a while, they're considered as some kind of a magic weapon, a game changer is the stupid term that everybody tries to use, but didn't change the game, didn't change anything, turned out to be rather useless, and they keep going with it for whatever reason. I don't know why. But that is just not very significant at all. Now, Azerbaijan actually tried to make a lot of money by having refineries and importing oil and selling it to the Kiev regime to fuel the war, literally. And the Russians have recently destroyed their refineries. So the Azeris are very upset about that. But they have lots and lots of reasons to be upset at this point, and being upset is not going to help them. They're in major trouble politically and economically at this point, and them being just very, very upset and unreasonable isn't going to help them. So Russia isn't going to allow this Azeri concession on behalf of the Kiev regime to continue. That is clear.
Who's playing the role in Ukraine? We know that NATO, we call NATO, but who's the major player in Ukraine today?
Well, it's sort of drifting out of control at the moment. The British thought that they had Zaluzhny buttoned up as the Zelensky replacement. But then there was this little subterfuge where a supposed mastermind of the team that supposedly blew up the Nord Stream pipelines using a pleasure yacht and some amateur scuba diving equipment and maybe some little satchels of explosive was somehow connected with Zaluzhny. So that is a kind of a clever bit of subterfuge to knock Zaluzhny out of the running as well, because now he's in the doghouse as the person who authorized the blowing up of the Nord Stream pipelines. And so there's going to be nobody in charge in Kiev pretty soon, because we all know that Zelensky is basically in the doghouse as far as Trump is concerned, and now Zaluzhny is going in the doghouse as well. And he was the big ace in the hole as far as the British were concerned. They cultivated him carefully and groomed him to become their man in Kiev. And I guess that's not going to work out as well. But the whole Nord Stream pipeline thing, as Seymour Hersh has unearthed, it was blown up by Navy SEALs, authorized by Joe Biden himself. But now that it's all going to get pinned on these Ukrainian tourists or whatever in a pleasure yacht, it turns out that, okay, well, you know, Americans will play a positive role now. They will invest some money in restoring the Nord Stream. Actually, one part of it, one line of it is still functional, just needs to be turned on. And what I guess they'll do is they'll buy Russian gas at the entrance to the pipeline and sell it to Germans, to the Germans at the exit to the pipeline, thus not violating any sanctions, and charging a little bit of a surcharge on the transportation costs, if you will. So that's in business, that's called a minor grift. So that makes Trump a minor grifter. But it's a beautiful scheme, you know. It's like, you don't have to buy Russian gas, you can buy American gas, because we've now renamed it. It's American, it's freedom molecules. And so that's kind of a beautiful plan, you know. It's yet another way to fleece the pathetic Germans who are still a U.S.-occupied territory with no sovereignty whatsoever. They'll just do whatever they're told.
I think Europeans came a long way since the conflict in Ukraine started. We haven't seen this sort of behavior from Europeans even during the Cold War. And you see Finland, Sweden, and Switzerland. It's somehow amazing to me what has happened to Switzerland. And we had Medvedev talking about if Austria joins NATO, there are going to be retaliatory, you know, measures on the part of Russians. What is going on in the mindset of Europeans? Why they're somehow investing so much in what's going on in Ukraine, which doesn't make sense to anybody. It doesn't benefit them. It hasn't benefited them.
Well, look, they only have one game plan left. Now that America is leaving Europe and basically robbing the Europeans blind on the way out, there's just one ploy, which is declare war on Russia and immediately surrender. Because they know, as a result of World War II, they think they know, what the Russians do to defeated nations is feed them, clothe them, build them hospitals and schools, and generally try to bring them up to world standards, as opposed to punishing them. You know, it's an amazing thing about Russia is that the nations that were so anti-Russian, including Finland, which built concentration camps in Karelia, where lots of Russian citizens got killed, got starved to death. You know, once once it was over, there were some measures taken by the Russians to make sure that, you know, Finnish Nazis were no longer running things. But the Finns were actually provided with a way to restore a modicum of sovereignty to their country. And provided they played nice, they were given access to the Russian market and prospered as a result for quite a while. Now that they've joined NATO and became so rabidly anti-Russian, they've ruined all of that and they're going destitute. And instead of Russian tourists shopping in Finland, you have Finnish shoplifters not shopping in Finland, but shoplifting. There's a plague of that. So that's a typical example. Same thing happened in Poland. After all of the Polish dalliances with Hitler, with Pilsudski and Hitler and all of that, after the Russians lost lots of troops liberating Poland from Hitler's troops, the first thing they did was they sent in lots of food and medicine and worked on restoring Poland and helping Poland. So this is the typical Russian standards of, okay, well, we have enemies among certain elites in various countries, but we never have enemies with any of the peoples. So their hope is declare war on Russia, surrender, the Russians will rush in and fix everything, because everything's falling apart and their only hope is that the Russians will now fix it. And I guess that that's their secret plan, because there is no other plan. It makes no other sense. What are they going to do? Go to war against Russia and hope to win? Well, they've already tried that, you see, and the Ukraine was the example of how they would lose if they were to go to war against Russia. So they can look at the Ukraine and say, well, the Ukrainians fought better than we ever could have, and they lost. So what are we?
I think the point that you raised is so much important for the mindset of the Russian president, at least, and his administration, it seems. He said that we don't have enemy states, we have enemy elites. He made this sort of division between the public opinion and the elites who are hating Russia. Do you think, when it comes to that sort of mindset, is there any sort of hope for Europe?
Not really. First of all, Europe is kind of washed out in terms of population. If you look at major cities in Europe, they're no longer European cities. They're African or Asian cities, peopled with African and Asian people. So they're no longer what they were, what they once were. The second point is that the Russians of today are not the Russians of the communist era, where internationalism was still all the rage, because people were taught that, you know, we're building communism on the entire planet. Even though the project is a little bit delayed, that's what we're striving for, is to liberate the entire planet, make everyone happy, make a just system for everyone. And the Russians are no longer with that program, you realize? So they really, really don't care about anything much outside of their borders. Now, that if a country wants to be friends with them and wants to be useful and has something to offer, like China, like India, like Iran, for instance, even Turkey, Bangladesh, then of course they'll work with it, and they'll maintain good relations, economic ties, all of that. But if a country is useless and hostile, the hell with it. You know, that's the Russian attitude, is you're on your own. If you mess up, like Finland did, for instance, you're on your own. Hungary, you know, or Slovakia, well, you're playing nice, you're trying, okay, we might help you a little bit. But don't ever think that you're just going to sit on our necks and dangle your feet and chew gum and everything will be wonderful. Same thing with, for instance, Azerbaijan and Armenia. It doesn't matter to Russia what they do. It really, most Russians don't really care. And the idea that they will rush in and fix everything and help everyone, forget it.
Dmitry, you feel that the only hope that someone could imagine about Europe would be the Austro-Hungarian states together with Serbia and other countries who are not happy with the situation in Europe?
Well, look, what are they good for as far as Russia is concerned? What do they need Serbia for instance? Well, there's some goat cheese that is Serbian feta, very tasty. I can't name another Serbian product that you can easily get at a Russian supermarket. What else does Serbia make that Russia really needs? On the other hand, Serbia does make weapons that end up in the hands of the Kiev regime that is being used to kill or attempt to kill Russian soldiers. And the Serbian government hasn't been able to stop that flow very easily, because that would cause unemployment, etc. So the Serbs want to have it both ways. So again, there are historical ties. You know, these are both Orthodox, Christian Orthodox nations. That's all very important. Culture is important. Geopolitics, not so important to Russia. Not so essential. I don't think Russia will risk very much. It will not risk the lives of Russian soldiers, I assure you, for the sake of Serbs, for the sake of Serbia. That's just not going to happen. And so, unfortunately, the Serbs are on their own. And unfortunately, they were used as whipping boys, as sort of proxies for Russians, while Russia was weak. That was the whole NATO attack on Serbia. It was like a practice attack on Russia. And that is, of course, very unfortunate. Russia couldn't really be all that helpful at the time, did what it could. But that's really in the past, and I don't think that there's going to be very much effort on the Russian side. Again, you know, Russia is conserving resources at this point and taking care of their own.
But when it comes to, you've mentioned Azerbaijan and Armenia, and we know that the British government is trying or is in the process of signing a strategic partnership with Armenia. So let's assume that that's the case. Russia is not caring about Armenia. What is the main reason for the British to be in Armenia? What do they want from Armenia? Is that related to Iran or is that related to the region?
Look, the UK at this point is has been. It is no longer a world power. It, economically, it's dead. Financially, it's about to go into some kind of IMF receivership because it's broke. It doesn't have armed forces anymore. Its armed forces are a joke. Its government is run by absolute total nincompoops that the people themselves absolutely hate. Trump is more popular in Britain than Keir Starmer, and neither of them is popular at all. And the place is just falling apart, right? The place is a shambles. So what they have left is the ability to be a nuisance internationally. They still have this tradition of special services, international men of mystery running around, stirring up trouble all over the world. And so they go to wherever they're troubled to be stirred up. And one of those places is Armenia, because the place is run by a traitor by the name of Nikol Pashinyan, you know, a Soros trainee, who is basically sent in there to wreck the place and turn it over to Turkey. And he seems to be succeeding at that. So that's what the Brits are doing anywhere, is they try to interfere. They basically, their goal now is to just basically show to themselves and the world that they still exist. You know, that's why they're trying to be some kind of a menace, because if they don't, then everybody will just forget that they exist at all.
Donald Trump, he said that the United States is making money out of Ukraine. We're not paying for the weapons. Europeans are paying and we're sending them to Ukraine. On the other hand, they're doing everything. They put 50% tariffs in India because of, they say that India is making money out of Ukraine. And how can you argue that when you, the president of the United States, simply saying that we are making money by selling weapons to Europeans. And on the other hand, you're asking India to sacrifice its security, its economy for the sake of Ukraine and a proxy war against Russia.
Okay, well, first of all, the tariff is not on India. It's on American consumers of Indian products. It's a stealth tax on the American consumer. The Indians might lose some sales, but to whom? Not to Americans. So Americans will have to buy that same stuff, but from another country, because the Americans can't match Indian wages and Indian productivity. So the reason that Trump uses these tariffs as a stick with which to sort of beat countries is, first of all, it's a PR maneuver. Secondly, it's one of the few things that he can control. He can impose tariffs, and Congress just sits back and does nothing. There was some consideration given to an idea of a new law that will prevent him from doing so, but that went nowhere because he still has a slight majority in Congress. So he can do this, play these stupid tariff games. But in terms of India's response, Trump doesn't know much, right? He's just some businessman, you know, some reality show host and, you know, real estate mogul who built some not very successful casinos. But he doesn't know the history of India's liberation from British rule. He doesn't know about Gandhi's boycott of British products. But the Indians remember. The Indians remember how Gandhi marched to the sea to collect salt, to break the British salt tariff, which affected the poorest of the population in India. Lots of other things that the Indians did. So homespun cloth. The British stole the manufacturing of cloth from India and moved it to Britain and then sold that cloth to Indians at inflated prices. That was their beautiful business plan. The way the Indians went around it was they started spinning and weaving their own homespun cloth and started wearing these homespun cloth garments, just completely negating the entire British cloth-based syndicate. And this cost the British a great deal of money. So this is a repeat, you know. It's something that's part of the Indian culture, that all they can do is pull it off the shelf, remember how it was done before, and think back and realize, you know, we're the country that destroyed the British Empire, okay? So now it's our time to destroy the American Empire. Hello, this is a repeat. And they're all eager to do it. It's a very realistic and encouraging and empowering thing that they're launching into.
What's so amazing, Dimitri, somehow to me is a geopolitical university, what's going on in the aftermath of what has happened in Ukraine. When the war started, we've been witnessing Russia saying no to the West for the first time, because they were trying to negotiate, to talk with the West. And no, it's enough. We're not going to get along with what they're doing. And in the aftermath of that, you see not only Russia, you see each and every country, see they can respond differently. There's some limits. The United States cannot do anything it wants to do against other countries. Do you think it has happened with the case of Iran, India, you see China with the case of tariffs? It's not just about the case of Ukraine. It's somehow we have two sort of countries, two sort of behaviors. On one side, you see the people in India, Iran, China, Russia, to some extent, some European countries, they trying to resist this sort of attitude of Washington. On the other hand, you see the countries that are getting more aligned with Washington. Is the learning process, what's going on, is that going to be somehow improved understanding of those countries who haven't decided about their future? How is that going to influence their mindset, in your opinion?
Well, Russia has clearly led the way, but now it's pretty much everybody except the occupied nations, the lackeys, the vassals, NATO. They have no choice. They basically have American troops stationed on their territory, and whoever stations their troops on your territory tells you how to behave and can overthrow your government, or not even overthrow it, but just like cancel it. So there is some number of countries that are just in for it. They're hapless. They can't resist. And that's most of Europe at this point. And then the rest of the world is just really moving on. The other thing is that Trump is actually helpful with this process. You know, his erratic tariffs, you know, his random number generator is making the United States look like an incredibly foolish and badly run country. And then things that come out of his mouth, like at some point he stood up and said in front of cameras into a microphone that world leaders, I'm not quoting him directly, but I think this is almost exactly what he said, world leaders are lining up to kiss my ass. Okay? That is not diplomatic language. Now, most people who get to a certain point in their careers where they're allowed to talk to representatives of other countries in public, they learn something called etiquette. I know it's a shock to Americans to hear that word because they've never heard it before. None of them have ever gone to a school that has a class on etiquette. They just have no idea what it is, but it's very important. Now, here you have this supposed leader of the free world, which sounds like a joke now, who has no idea about etiquette, who talks about world leaders kissing his ass. And he just basically sounds like a fool. He sounds like a fool. And so it is very hard to oppose a powerful country that is run by powerful men that know what they're doing, that sound and act purposefully. And on the other hand, if it's a clown show, and that then it's sort of you almost have to ignore it because it's too humiliating to pay attention to. It's sort of like, you show up at a world conference and there is a leader of a certain country defecating in a corner. Okay, well, etiquette says you don't pay any attention to that. You pretend it's not happening. You look the other way. So that's what most of the planet is forced to do now, given that Trump is in the White House and talking about world leaders lining up to kiss his ass.
You know, what Donald Trump is achieving in the case of China and India is amazing because these two countries are coming together like never. We haven't seen this sort of, you know, closeness before. And do you feel that India, we talked about India before, what's going on in mind of Indians when they see the United States pushing so hard toward them? While the vice president of the United States said, we cannot go that far against China because there are a lot to be considered. But when it comes to India, we can go farther. We can put a lot of pressure on them. How is that going to influence the Indian mindset, in your opinion?
I don't know, but they've put up quite a battle when it came to the British. So like I said, it's a rerun for them. They've done it before. in terms of the United States helping push countries together, well, it's sort of the other way. U.S. foreign policy for a long time was the idea of driving a wedge between the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China, which were very close because both were communist countries. And they sort of succeeded, but really what happened was that this Ukrainian by the name of Khrushchev took over the Kremlin and absolutely destroyed Stalin's legacy. And by doing so has greatly upset the Chinese leadership to a point where Russia or the Soviet Union became toxic to the Chinese. And then Gorbachev came along and flew to China during the Tiananmen Square episode, which was an an early attempt at a color revolution in China and supported the rebellion, which really basically made Russia a pariah as far as the Chinese were concerned. And it wasn't until Putin came to power and shored things up and basically just got rid of all this, all of this garbage that accumulated between the two countries and settled everything, that relations between Russia and China went back to normal. So the Americans can take some amount of credit for wrecking the relationship between the Soviet Union and PRC, but I think the Russians really did it to themselves, or the Ukrainians in their mixed, as it were. There was a period of time where there were a lot of Ukrainians in the Kremlin, which turned out to be a major problem. But in terms of India and China agreeing to cooperate, that is a natural development. And I think that at this point, there's a chance that they will shore up their relationship. The big question is, these two countries are competitors in some way. So the Indians can assemble, iPhones as well as the Chinese. In other ways, they cooperate because the Indians, speaking English, a lot of them, are much better at providing service, whereas the Chinese service for all of the manufactured stuff that China pushes out is pretty pathetic. All of the Chinese made stuff that all of the equipment, et cetera, that comes over, the documentation is pathetic and the service is non-existent. So China and India could work together very well, where China makes stuff and India provides tech support for it. That would be a wonderful relationship, and they should really work on that.
Yeah, amazing. Good suggestion, by the way, Dmitry. We know that Russia, Iran, North Korea, Belarus, Serbia, many countries would go to China for China's grand parade. How does China feel about the whole thing? It's not just about the Middle East and Ukraine. We see the same thing in Venezuela. The United States is somehow escalating the situation. They're trying to put a lot of pressure on the Venezuelan president, say. And how do you see the way that China sees what's going on?
I don't know. It's just a pageant, and a parade. That's all it is. And it's a way to see who's friends and who's not. So the fact that Modi is going to Beijing is a big deal, because there was a cooling off in relations, and now they're warming up again, and so that's good. In terms of the fact that everybody's going except the Europeans, no European head of state is going. Well, that's significant. That's significant. That means Europe is not part of the picture anymore. Finally, everybody is, including the Europeans themselves, I think, everybody understands that no European country has sovereignty. There are no sovereign states left in Europe. They're all vassals, lackeys, and crypto colonies.
Dmitry, do you feel that Donald Trump would escalate or would somehow find? He said recently, just today we've learned from The Atlantic, it says that the way that Europe and together with Ukrainian are pushing for the terms that Ukraine considers as security guarantee, they're somehow not acceptable even for Donald Trump. It says that it seems that he understands after that meeting with Vladimir Putin, and he understands that Russia would not agree on those terms that they're pushing for. two options for the United States, escalating and going against India as they're pushing for as we talk. And maybe China, Brazil, because Lindsey Graham was talking about it, tweeting about it. They're prepared to do that. Or, after all, they understand what's going on and they may find, Donald Trump may find some sort of common ground between the two parties. Which would be...
Well, look, well, okay, first of all, before I said there's a drinking game where any time the talking heads say ceasefire, you drink and you end up completely drunk before you know it. Well, no more ceasefire. That trope wore itself out. The new one is security guarantees. So now whenever they say security guarantees, you drink and you end up drunk before you know it. You know, so that's the new drinking game. That's all it is. In terms of who can provide the Ukraine or the former Ukraine or whatever is left of it with a security guarantee, there's just one country in the world that can do that. That's Russia. Russia is not going to provide the Ukraine with security guarantees until the Ukraine is everything that Russia wants it to be, which is demilitarized, denazified, neutral, and generally friendly and controllable as far as the Russians are concerned, with full rights restored to the Russian-speaking population, which is the majority in the Ukraine, and with all of the foreign troops flushed out. So, or mercenaries, whoever they are. And so that's not what the Europeans are talking about. That's not what the Americans are talking about. And so that's not something worth talking about. Okay. So we can talk about it, but it's just a drinking game. Okay. We're not really talking about anything real. We're just getting drunk. Okay. The only country that can provide the Ukraine with a security guarantee that's worth anything is Russia.
How about Poland, Romania, Hungary, and these countries who have, I think, the minorities in Ukraine? They're important for the future of Ukraine, western part of Ukraine.
Yeah, well, they can choke on the western regions of the former Ukraine. Those were only made part of the Soviet Union as a result of World War II, and a lot of people, excuse me, a lot of people consider that Stalin's mistake. Those provinces should have never been joined to the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, and the populations of those areas, being not just part Polish, part Romanian, part Hungarian, etc., but part this really bizarre tribe, and having lots of serious problems, such as a lot of them are mentally retarded because there is a lack of iodine in the groundwater. Excuse me. Those people are trouble. So if the Poles, the Hungarians, and the Romanians want to choke on them, I don't think the Russians will mind.
I think, Dmitry, that would be a very very important move if all these countries who are bordering Ukraine coming together, talking to each other. Do you feel that would happen, or the influence of the United States and NATO is so much on these countries that they're not going to be in that sort of mindset to come together and talk with Russia?
Well, how are they? Why is it useful to talk to them? I mean, there were a number of agreements between Russia and the West as far as, excuse me, getting over a cold. As far as the Ukraine is concerned, there was Minsk I, and the result of that was Europe constantly yammering away about Russia not fulfilling the terms of Minsk I, although Russia was basically a guarantor to the process, but not a participant, so it had no obligations. Same thing with Minsk II. And then there were the Istanbul Accords that were basically scrapped. So how many tries do these clowns get before Russia says no more deals for you? I mean, you see that the Russian army is doing a perfectly respectable job chewing through the Ukrainian military, and NATO has nothing to offer at this point. And so if it goes this way, then at some point, somebody who's really in charge, who's probably somebody sitting in the Pentagon, will say, this is useless. Okay, and just let's go home. Let's just forget about it. Tell our people that it's over and just get rid of this nonsense. And that's the way it's going, because you see, it went from we'll deal Russia a strategic defeat to a Russian victory is unacceptable to let's see who can provide the Ukraine with security guarantees. Anybody at all? Anybody ever? And it doesn't seem to be happening. And so they're haggling over that. But it also went from the United States sending lots of weapons and lots of money to the Kiev regime, to the Europeans being told that they have to pony up the money and send the weapons to the Ukrainians, to the Europeans saying, well, we're kind of out of money and we're about to just like be in the hole with the IMF, and we're broke and we can't do this anymore, and we have more Ukrainian refugees than we can feed, so what can we possibly do? So that's the next step. And then Russia will say, okay, well, remember that memo we gave you a while ago that spelled out certain conditions? Well, here's a new memo which spells out certain conditions, except that the conditions are a lot worse, just like we promised. Now you can basically fulfill these conditions, or you can wait for our next memo. That's the whole plan. That's all that's happening. Now, all that yammering away, okay, that about security guarantees or ceasefire or whatever, that's a drinking game.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dmitry, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
And let us know, before going, your website. And
the URL is on the screen. Okay, please go there, register, join the discussion. There's usually a very interesting, lively discussion going on, and read my articles. That's what I highly recommend.
Thank you. See you soon, Dmitry.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.